Today we have Andrea Corey from the ABA Center for Children and the Law. We have Judge Nushin Saifi, who is a circuit judge in the 11th Circuit, where she presides over dependency cases, and also Justin Taylor, who's a member of USHINE. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Andrea.
Great. Thanks, Liz. I just want to be sure. I heard you, Judge. Justin, are you on the line?
Correct. I'm here.
Excellent. Great. Thanks. So glad that you could join us. I really appreciate everyone taking an hour out of their day to talk about the issue of youth coming to court. And just to sort of tell you what you got over your email, a few things. You received two articles that the ABA Center on Children and the Law published in the Child Law Practice. The first one is Seen and Heard involving youth in their court hearings, and the next one is With or Without You. Again, it's how to involve children in court, and that article kind of goes into detail about how to prepare the kids, how it also talks to the court about what kinds of questions to ask, what kinds of things to talk about. Then you also have your the PowerPoint that we're going to go through, and then you also have the child participation chart, which I think is just an incredible document, and I really appreciate the Guardian Ad Litem program for putting it together. It goes through pretty much your statute and your rules in any place that indicates child participation, either in court hearings or in other circumstances. It cites it there, and I think it's going to be really helpful to kind of have that all in one place. And I plan on giving a talk to your judges at a judicial conference, and I plan on giving that to those judges as well, so they understand the importance of child participation and all of the ways in which the statute and the rules contemplate having youth participate in these kinds of cases and in hearings in particular. Thanks for giving us the statewide motions to produce child, the proposed order, and then the transport order. I thought that these would be great for all of you to have on hand, because as we were sort of planning this call, I was asking what are some of the areas that are a struggle for getting youth in court. Do I have to concentrate on this call on getting the buy-in? And I was told that pretty much all of the guardians at Item are bought on to the idea of having youth in court and the importance of youth in court, but just that there are times when their courts and when their judges are not as bought in, if you will, to having youth in court. And so if that is the case in your jurisdiction, and Judge Saifi is actually also going to comment on this, that here are some tools that you can use to ensure that your clients are present at their court hearings. So that's what you have. And this is kind of interesting. This is the first time that I've done this sort of a teleconference, and I generally do a very interactive training, and I know how hard it is because we're all on the call, but I really encourage questions and comments. So if you do have a question, please don't hesitate to speak up. So with that being said, we're going to go ahead and get started unless there are any questions or comments. Nope, great. Okay. How this is going to work is we're going to hear from Justin, because he's a former foster youth, and I think I usually do not do these trainings if I do not have a youth present, because, you know, it's easy for me as a practicing child attorney to stand up and say, oh, all of my clients, you know, do this or that. But it's quite another thing to actually hear from youth who have been in the foster care system about their experiences and why it's really important that they are in court and to talk about their experiences. And it keeps all of us honest. It keeps all of us really in tune to, we're talking about these youth and how important it is to empower them and give them a voice. So I asked Dustin to kind of talk for a bit about his experiences in care, how many placements he's been in, his school changes, and then talk about his experience with his guardian ad litem and then in court. And then after Justin speaks, we're going to hear from Judge Safi about her experiences with youth coming to court, some tips from the bench in your own jurisdiction, and then I'm going to round out the hour by just talking a bit about some tips on a national perspective about how to involve youth in court in a meaningful way. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Justin.
Andrea, thank you. I appreciate it. My name is Justin Taylor. I'm 26 years old. I manage several companies, and I'm also a business owner, yet the most important thing to me right now is giving back and helping foster children. And, of course, not because I've heard their stories and want to help, but because I used to be one of those children. Now, currently I do. I sit on the statewide board for Florida Youth Shine, advocating in the best interest for these foster children. And one of the biggest issues that I continue to hear is the fact that these kids are not able to go to court. A lot of this does stem from not having any means of transportation or even the knowledge about it, and the end result, they have no idea what's going on. My situation was different. I had one placement. I was in the Boys Home Association in Jacksonville. But I attended all my court hearings with no problem, and because of that, I know and understand everything that has happened with my case. And if I wanted to talk to the judge personally, I could. If there were problems I needed to address, I could. And in my eyes, everything was dealt with and handled accordingly. But now let's turn the page for a moment, and let's say there's a child who never attends his or her court hearings. All they know are the details explained to them by the caseworkers, the guardians, caregivers, etc. And I guess for an example, have you ever played the game telephone? I'm sure somebody on this call has. If not, I'll explain. The game starts with a group of people. One person whispers a sentence to the other the same, and this continues until everyone in the room has heard the sentence. Now, I assure you, throughout this game, pieces of the sentence will change. Now, incorporate that scenario with a child not being able to go to court. The message is relayed to them from a caregiver who may have gotten their information from the caseworker. This will definitely leave room for confusion for the child. But how about an easier scenario? Let's say the child has a question that the caseworker or caregiver cannot answer. Don't you think it would have been a little bit easier just to have the child in court? Now, being a part of Florida Youth Shine, I have the opportunity to talk with current foster children, and when asked, most of them have no idea what's going on in their cases. These kids are consistently being told that they will be able to attend the hearing, but when the time comes, they find out it's too late. For example, we have a 13-year-old girl in the local chapter of Youth Shine who has developed a strong interest in this issue. Her setback is transportation. You mean to tell me there is no one who can pick this girl up and take her to her own hearing? Now, she expresses a strong interest. There's just nobody there to take her. And in fact, out of the 12 youth that I've talked to about this, there are actually 6 who never go to their hearing. Now, do you care to guess how many of them actually do not want to go to their hearing? 0. Now, 50% of these kids who don't go, they all want to take part in what's happening in their own life, but can't because they're uninformed of the date or there's no transportation. And in my opinion, that's no excuse at all. And like I said, during my time in foster care, I was well informed of my situation. I also know people who never knew or understood what was happening in their case. For example, there's a certain TPR case when I was in care, and the child never knew it. He had no idea that the woman that he knew as his mother would sue me losing her parental rights. Now, I'm a firm believer the child should go to court if it's within their best interest. If I had to pick an age, I'd say 13, maybe 12, but it is the child's right to attend these hearings. And these children truly do deserve to be seen and heard. A child's a person, flesh, blood, not just a case, not a portfolio, not a file or a sheet of paper. This is their life. This is their future. And we need to put everything in reality for them. We need to help these kids become leaders in the community, business owners, husbands, wives, college graduates, and we cannot do this by suppressing their reality. We can't do this by withholding information from them. How would you like for your banker to keep your financial information from you? So don't keep these kids' life from them. Life is full of surprises, and there's no need to create more. These kids, including myself, have been through so much heartache and pain as it is, and you've got to be open and upfront with them. The judge needs to see the child, not a case, not a file. Most foster children have been pushed around and made to feel unimportant, and it's time to make them feel important. Now, I'd like for everyone on the call to just close your eyes just for a moment, and obviously I'm not going to know whether or not you're doing this, but we're going to take a little trip. So imagine you're in a courtroom, and I'll make it even better for you. You're the judge in that courtroom. You're overseeing a custody hearing. A child currently in care may be going to live with a relative. Now, on paper, everything looks good. Background check was okay. The home inspection was great. As a judge, what do you do? Your decision will change the child's life forever. Did you ever meet this child? Maybe the relatives have a history of abuse with the child. Now the child has never spoken up about this because he or she is, of course, afraid. But since the child is just a short time away from going to live with these people, maybe it's time to talk. The child may not want to tell the caregiver, the caseworker, or even the guardian ad litem, but maybe as a judge, he or she will tell you. But how do you know? You've only seen a file. Now look at the file sitting in front of you. Let's make it more personal and imagine this is your son or your daughter. You care enough about them to look out for their best interests. Why not a foster child? Thank you.
Excellent, Justin. I just have a couple questions, and then I'm actually going to open it up to the audience, because, again, I think that we learn so much from speaking with current and former foster youth. So there has been one of the big concerns that I've heard when traveling around talking with judges trying to get courts to involve youth in their court hearings, one of the concerns is that the information that the youth is going to hear could potentially upset the youth and cause them harm. How would you sort of address that concern that the court has?
How could you, and I understand everybody is trying to protect the child. You know, the child's best interest is at heart. But sitting there and trying to withhold, a child being in court and possibly hearing something that's going to upset them, they know everything. You know, my mother was an alcoholic. So sitting in that courtroom, I knew she was an alcoholic. You weren't telling me anything that I didn't know. You know, a child's going to know if they've been sexually abused. You know, if their parents are alcoholics or drug addicts. You know, they know all this. So trying to protect them and not upset them by taking them, I don't think that's an excuse at all.
Okay. When you were able to attend your court hearings, were you able to speak to the judge, and how did that play out? Was it in the courtroom with all of the attorneys present? Was it in chambers? How did that work?
I could have, and I was asked if I needed to talk to the judge in chambers. I could. I never really felt the need to, but I did know that the opportunity was there if I needed. I did talk with the judge, with everybody else around, and that was to me that was good enough for me. But yeah, the opportunity was there if I needed to.
Excellent. One last question that I have. There's another concern that is often brought up, in that most of youth that are in foster care are school age, and they're going to have to miss school because of their court hearings. How would you sort of address that concern?
That's a tough one, because it's hard to say, hey, you're going to have to miss school to do this. Obviously, school is important. But at the same time, a foster child is living a totally different life. You know, school will help them out, to get to a certain point. Being in foster care, listening to their court hearing, understanding what's going on in their life, to me, is a little more important. I missed school to go to my hearings. And of course, I would have to make it up. And I think that's something that should be done. Miss school, if absolutely need be, and make up whatever work you have.
Okay, great. Are there any questions from the audience for Justin?
Yes. This is Wanda Davis from Pasco County, and I have a question about telephonic hearings for children. A lot of times, children are not transported, but we may get, let's say, a case manager say, oh, but the child can participate via the telephone, and the equipment is not very good, and you cannot hear the child, or the child cannot hear what's going on in the courtroom. Justin, have you had any experience with that, and what do you think about telephone hearings for children by way of participation?
Wanda, thanks for your question, and I've never had any experience with that, but in my opinion, if, like what you're saying, if it's the child isn't heard clear enough, it needs to be clear. And also with that, I think it's you need to be more personal. The judge and the child need to be, in my opinion, face to face. The judge needs to be able to physically see the child sitting in front of him or her.
Okay, and I have another question. Did you ever receive copies of the court documents, the JRs or JSSRs or the status reviews prior to the court hearings you attended? And if so, how important was that to you to know what was being reported to the court about you and your family?
No, ma'am. Actually, I never did receive those documents, but I kind of, now that you bring it up, I wish I would have. I think it is very important to know, for the child to know what's being reported.
And if I may I ask you one other question? Besides the court hearings, did you ever attend things like case planning conferences and staffings? And if so, did you find those valuable to you?
I didn't. I never attended those.
Did you want to?
I actually never knew about them.
Okay. Thank you.
I would have liked to.
Okay. Thank you for your answers.
That I got software.
I'm sorry. Is there another question for Justin? Anyone have anything else that you would like to ask Justin? Okay, great. Justin, we really appreciate the time that you took to come and speak to us. I think it's really important for the audience to understand that every time either a foster youth or a former foster youth comes and speaks, they really share a part of themselves, a part of their lives with us. So we really appreciate, again, Justin, the time that you took. Okay, so, Judge, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
All right, well, thank you, everybody. I'm actually coming up on my one-year anniversary as a judge, and I've been in dependency court the whole time, so I guess I'm not the most experienced. But, from the very, very beginning, I was guided by the lawyers, I'd say predominantly by the guardian lawyers who are in my chambers right now and participating in the phone call and in the training. I was guided by them to have children come to court. So for me, it's really been the norm since I began as a judge. And to the credit of, you know, my jurisdiction, the administrative judge here, Cindy Lederman, shortly after I began, issued an administrative order requiring every judge in dependency to actually see a child face-to-face within the first 6 months of cases open. So I'm happy to say that I think that was pretty much the practice in my courtroom for the most part anyway. Any time a child is brought to court, from my perspective, I can see how it's very empowering for the child. I think that court is something that, you know, by definition, dependency court is something that's happening to the child. And I think that, you know, they can feel very out of control, especially when they're older. I think it gives them a sense of security to come into court, to meet the judge, and to at least be exposed to this process. I mean, our courts are about justice, and I think that justice in large part is about process. And I spend a lot of time making sure that the parents are given due process. In my mind, it's equally important, if not more important, for children, especially the older children, to have a voice in that process and for them to understand what's happening and hopefully to have a sense, you know, that justice is being done on their behalf. That's from the perspective of the child. From my perspective as a judge, it's always worthwhile for me to meet the children on a case. And, I mean, it can sometimes be something as dramatic as me realizing that a child may have a learning disability or a speech problem that maybe hasn't been addressed yet. In many cases, and actually part of the reason I was almost late on this phone call was to discuss with a child who was, there was domestic violence and sexual abuse allegations in the petition involving her. I needed to speak with her about whether or not she wanted to have visitation with her father. And that's something that I don't think there's any substitute in that situation for me speaking with a child, you know, one-on-one, you know, outside of court. So it can be very dramatic, but I guess less dramatic is just giving me a sense of what the a family dynamic might be if the family's still in the picture. It gives me an opportunity to know what the child wants, what they're expecting, what's most important to them. And these days, I'm sure all of you have heard, we have, you know, efforts in place, and we talk about normalizing the life of a child in foster care. It really gives me a sense of what I need to do as a judge or what needs to be done to help normalize a child's experience in foster care. And, I mean, I can talk with them about something as serious as, you know, birth control, or as, you know, I have other children come in and say, I need a new pair of shoes, or I want a cell phone, or I need a laptop. And I always tell them, I want you to tell me whatever you need or want. I can't always deliver, but I will always try. Sometimes they want to be on the football team. Sometimes they, you know, there's extracurricular activities that they want to take part in. So I think those things cannot be ignored. And I think it really helps me when I meet a child to, you know, to talk with them and to get them to feel comfortable letting me know what they want. So in a nutshell, I'm happy that you're all on the line, and I'm happy that you're obviously all have an interest in this. I think there's so much to be gained from having youth in the court. I think there's no downside, and I'm going to encourage all of you to make it a standard part of your practice. The way it works in my courtroom, and I would say this is really case by case, very often, like the example I gave you earlier today, I spoke to the child in chambers with the guardian present, no record, and honestly, that was the practice initially for a long time. Most often, especially with younger children, I think there are a lot of things that go on in the courtroom that they don't understand and that they don't need to be exposed to. So for younger kids, I typically don't have them in the courtroom. I typically have them in my chambers. If that's going on, or if it's something that's going to be starting happening in your jurisdictions, I would encourage you to encourage your judges. I have lollipops in my chambers. I have books. I have teddy bears that are delivered to us by a couple of charities in Miami. So I do my best to, you know, make the kids feel at home and, you know, feel happy with a lollipop and a book, get sort of acclimated to my chambers, and always have somebody, as a rule, I always have somebody present. As far as the timing that Justin brought up, I do my best, if the child's in school, to try to do it later in the day or early in the morning so that we minimize them missing school. Or sometimes we've scheduled things on, you know, a child's day off from school. But I think that, again, the judges need to be aware of that. I agree with Justin that I think sometimes school has to be, take, I guess, a second seat to them coming to court, but I really don't like to make that the habit. So if there's anything I can do to accommodate them getting a full day of school, I will. So late in the day or early in the morning works well for me, and I would encourage you all to see if that works in your jurisdictions as well. I like to know ahead of time when I'm going to see a child in a perfect world, and usually, I would say probably at least half the time I'll have a heads up so I can be familiar with the case beforehand. But probably the other half, especially with my teens, I have many of them just showing up. Sometimes they've run away. So I think to the extent, especially if this is something that's just beginning with your judges who are uncomfortable, it's nice to have it scheduled ahead of time. Then again, I think the judge and all of you sort of have to be ready that if, it, you know, parents show up in court with a child, or if the custodians show up in court with a child, at that point when the child is there, absolutely at that moment the child has to be included, whether it's in chambers or in court, you know, or sidebar. You don't miss that opportunity. If the child is there, I'm talking to them. I'm not going to make them come back because it's not scheduled. So I think that that's something that, you know, everyone needs to be aware of also. When I do it in court, I tend to do it sidebar, and recently I had a clerk in my courtroom, and she had a chair next to me. I've left that chair there. So now when the kids come into court, I go off the record, they come sidebar, and whether they have anything to say to me or not, I always make sure they come sidebar so we have a little one-on-one and I can find out how they're doing and what they need and what's going on and just give them a little, you know, pep talk. And I always tell them that they are welcome to come to court absolutely any time. And if they need to see me, even if it's before the next court date, I tell them to let the guardian know, let the case manager know, and get before me. And more often than not, and I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but I give them my card, and my phone number is on there. And I actually do have a handful of children, and we can all comment on this afterwards, who do call me up and I have conversations with them, and they do show up at my door here in chambers pretty regularly. And I'm sure there are many, many, many judges who wouldn't think that's a good idea or who wouldn't be comfortable with that. I personally am comfortable with that. I always make sure that the guardians or the case managers know that that's what's going on. It's not like I'm having, you know, making some big decisions. But I want the child to feel comfortable, and I want them to feel like they have access to me. And I think sometimes, you know, you have good case managers and you have bad ones. And I think that sort of my end run around that is to just go directly to the child and say, here's my number. If you need me, I am here, you know, all day, every day, and I'm here to talk with you. I just wanted to give you all some examples of cases where it's been really beneficial to me. And I've sort of learned on the job, things have come up, and then I've learned, you know, in the short year I've been here, things that I need to make sure I do from here on out. I had one case recently where I've never had a situation where I've spoken to a child in chambers and told the child things were confidential, where I had to then disclose on the record what the child told me. Typically, it's not usually that dramatic. Of course, we say that never happens, and then sure enough, I had a case recently where there was a child. The mother had previously been reunified with this child one or two times and had been failed reunifications. She'd had a couple of relapses with drugs. And at this point, though, since I had been on the case, the mother was doing very well. She was testing negative. She was in compliance on, I think, at least her last two, maybe last three judicial reviews. So the case really looked like it was a reunification case, and I had not met with the children yet. And the older child had asked to speak with me. I brought him into chambers. I spoke to him one-on-one, and he expressed serious reservations about being reunified with his mother, very mature, and he very clearly stated to me that he didn't trust her, that even though she was clean now, he didn't believe she was going to remain clean, and that some of his visitations, he just had a lot of fear and apprehension. And that is something that I would not have known but for speaking with him. And I also would not have known, I don't think I would have had a good handle on how mature and how really adult his statement and his decision-making was on that. I mean, if I hadn't spoken with him, I would have thought, well, this is just a kid who's talking or perhaps being manipulated by caregivers. But speaking with him one-on-one, it was absolutely, at that point, I came to the decision that I was not going to make this child reunify with his mother, and there are very, you know, good reasons, all that were in his best interest not to do that. At that point, I realized that I had to explain to him that I was going to have to go back into court and put something on the record because the mother was moving for reunification. So you need to all be mindful in those situations to make sure the judge, or if you are speaking to the child, if the judge is speaking to the child off the record, that the child understands that to the extent possible, if things are going to be, you know, personal, the judge should try and keep things personal and confidential. But the bottom line is if the judge has to make a legal decision based on something the child tells them, then the judge would have to put on the record what happened. And in that case, I had to do that. I went back into court, and I basically summarized what he had said to me, and I made a legal decision not to reunify at that time based on that. And, you know, thankfully it went well so far. But, you know, the mother clearly had a right to object and initially was objecting. So if I had just made that decision without disclosing what he had told me, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. And it was information that I really could only get from the child. In domestic violence cases, I think it's very important for a judge to speak with the children. Domestic violence cases, we tend to treat them sort of as, you know, we refer to them as domestic violence cases, but within that subcategory, I think there's so many differences and nuances. And you know, is it a parent involved in the domestic violence? Is it a step parent? Was it an isolated situation? Is it a regular occurrence? And I think that our system, placing children under the supervision of court, is so fraught with its own problems that for me as a judge, I weigh very heavily whether or not we're going to be involved in a case. I don't want to substitute one set of problems, you know, system problems for the dysfunction that the child may face in the family. So in the domestic violence cases in particular, I think it really helps to sit down with the children in the case and talk to them, again, with the guardian present, off the record, in chambers, and make them feel comfortable and get them to sort of talk about the family dynamic and get a sense of, you know, how much fear is there and is it, you know, what sort of therapy is needed? Do they need, you know, individual therapy? Is it a situation where you can start right off the bat with putting therapy in place for the whole family, or is it a situation where the family really needs to be kept apart, you know, the parents need to be kept away from each other and from the child, you know, pending the pending any future services?
Okay,
So, again, in cases like that, and I guess really in every case, I do make sure as a rule that, you know, everyone needs to be notified. I've never had anybody object to me speaking to the children, and I don't know if that would be different in other jurisdictions, but I do think it's important. And again, if you're asking the judge to speak to a child, make sure the judge or someone informs all the parties on the case so that if there are any objections regarding the child being spoken to, those are noted and any, you know, conditions can be laid out so that it would be agreeable to everybody. For the children that are, I guess like Justin, you know, what he was talking about reminds me very much of the kids that are, to me, almost the most compelling. And those are the kids who are transitioning youth who are aging out of foster care. I honestly can say that I feel like I am a surrogate parent to these children. And I don't, again, don't know whether that's, you know, what should be my role or not. But I feel for better or for worse, that is my position. And I don't know if it's because I am a parent already, but I feel like my duties go so beyond anything that I would have ever learned in law school or judge school. I think it's my job to inspire them and to prepare them to age out and to be successful, you know, adults. For many of them, I feel like if they have contact with me sort of regularly, it discourages them from running away. Sometimes they run away and come here, which, you know, is a step up from running away and us not knowing where they are. I always ask them to articulate their goals. I think it's important for children. I would say as early as, you know, 12, 13 years old, if it becomes apparent that this is a child who's likely going to age out of the foster care system, they need to be inspired and they need to start having some sense of consequences and some sense of goals. And I think that that's so often lost on them, and it has been lost on them, especially if they've been in foster care since they were young. I tell them what my goals for them are. Typically, I'll say, you know, well, I'd like to see you finish your education. I'd like to see you be independent. I'd like to see you go to college. And I let them know as best I can that I believe in them and that they have all the potential to be successful. And if they're doing well, I make sure that that's, and they're in court, I make sure that everyone in the courtroom is aware that they're doing well. And I tell them that I'm proud of them. I tell them they should be proud of themselves. So I really think a large part of dealing as a judge with the transitioning youth is really to inspire them and to make them feel good about themselves. I definitely privately discuss with definitely all the girls and actually a lot of the boys also. I discuss birth control with them. I discuss sexually transmitted diseases with them. I discuss relationships with them. And sometimes they're not comfortable talking about it, but again, I do it privately. That's not something I put on the record. And I try to make them feel comfortable about that and let them know that that's something that is personal. They can always talk to me about it. And, you know, while I prefer them not to have sex, if they, you know, if it's something that they're concerned about, I do want them to be educated, and I do want them to feel comfortable coming to me if they need birth control or something like that. And again, what I said earlier about normalizing, I'll talk to them about what they may need. I mean, typical kids these days, teenagers in Miami anyway, most teenagers have cell phones and have laptop computers and they play football and they have, you know, nice clothes. And I know that, you know, that may be an excess here and it may be something that foster children, you know, don't need to have. You know, it's not as important as obviously a good roof over their heads and a good functioning household. But I do recognize that it's important for them to feel normal and to go to school and sort of have the things that their peers have. So to the extent that I can, you know, find someone I know who has a cell phone they're willing to donate or a laptop they're willing to donate, or, you know, that ends up being what I sort of do on my side job, is I rally my friends and people that I know and see what I can get for these kids. And I think that, you know, the Guardian program is wonderful at letting me know what their needs are. And I encourage you all, again, to talk to your children and make sure the judge knows this is what the child wants, even if it's something that you may think is, I don't know, not as important. Of course, a cell phone's not as important as, you know, a good foster parent. But in my mind, it's still something that's important to the child, and I don't think those needs or wants should be ignored. And I think also, especially with the transitioning youth, many of them end up trying to regain contact, sometimes with TPR parents, sometimes with siblings, with some adult from their past. I say it all the time, at a certain age, these kids are going to have contact with people whether we want them to or not. I mean, in Miami, there's a lot of runaways, and, you know, during the day, if they have some level of freedom, they're going to go have contact with people whether we approve them or not. So what I try to do is get them to tell me who it is they want to have contact with and try to get them to talk about it and see if I can involve that person, have that person come to court, get a background check done, and just, you know, if they're going to have contact anyway, let's at least try to see who this person is and include them and keep a close eye on it, maybe offer supervised visitation and just have an idea of who the child is using for support structure and whether that person is really a good person or not. And then finally, what I said earlier is I think it's important, more often than not, if the child has a learning disability or any kind of special needs, that comes to me through the case manager or through certain assessments we have done or through the guardians. Occasionally, I will pick up on something that, you know, may not have been addressed and or may not be addressed to my satisfaction, and I'll bring that up, and that's definitely another good reason for having the children in court. And finally, I just think for me as a judge, you know, I think Justin said it, you know, better than I'm going to. I don't want the file in front of you really is a cold, hard, you know, black and white piece of paper. And until you really see, you know, I get to know all the players in a case. And honestly, again, our whole system is based on the children. So to get to know the parents on a case and to get to know, you know all the case manager, to not get to know a child makes no sense to me on these cases. So for me, at the end of the day, the most important thing is it really gives me a sense of what the case is all about when I get to put a name and a face and you know, a personal relationship that I have with the child. So I don't know if there are any questions right now. I was just going to take a few moments and discuss with you, obstacles in all of you doing this. In our jurisdiction, I'm happy to say, I don't think we have those obstacles. Transportation here, if it's ever brought up as an issue, I've never seen it be an issue. I pretty much order the child to be brought to court, and the child is brought to court. If we can discuss that, I guess, in a moment, if that's going to be an issue. But I frankly think it's the judge's job to order, you know, the judge has to see the child. So I don't think transportation can ever really be an excuse. I will tell you, I started here as a judge November 5th, 7. A month later, I was at a circuit court conference. And in one of the trainings that had to do with dependency court, I brought up the topic of children coming to court. And I probably had, you know, a good 75% of my older, much more experienced colleagues looking at me like I was crazy. So I will tell you, I'm sure you all might get some resistance, especially in, you know, other counties than Miami. And that surprises me. I think part of the problem is many judges, especially the more experienced judges and especially the ones that do family work, in the context of a family case, you know, a divorce or custody battle, I've seen the judges absolutely do not ever want the child brought in. They think it's a bad tactic, and they think it's terrible for the child to be sort of in between the two parents. So I can understand that mindset in those situations. I think the problem is so many judges in dependency, if they've done family or if there's an overlap, that's their mindset. So it's hard to sort of bring them out of that. Many of them are also concerned about the child's, you know, I don't know what they're really concerned about, but I know that they're very wary of having conversations with anybody off the record. They're wary of having conversations with a child off the record. And I think that can easily be remedied by just making sure a guardian or somebody is present. I think that the beauty of Miami and Judge Lederman, who's, you know, probably one of the best dependency judges in the state, everything that she does and she has been doing in this jurisdiction for the last, gosh, probably 20 years, is backed by scientific evidence. There is a lot of literature now that supports bringing children to court. And, you know, I didn't even need to see it because I thought it was a good idea. But to the extent that there are judges that are resistant to it, I would encourage you to, you know, either to get the literature. If you need to, you can email me and I'll get some of it from Judge Lederman. And you can show them that, you know, the trend across the country and the evidence, you know, psychological, psychiatric, you know, whatever, otherwise supports bringing children to court, having them be present in hearings to the extent that it's, you know, not harmful to them, and having them have a real voice in the system. It's so we should be doing it, and actually it's just the law sort of, you know, once again lagging behind the science that's already there. I think as a rule you tell the judge, the guardian, or the case manager should be present. I have a comfort level now with many of the children, so when they show up sort of on their own or want to talk to me by themselves, I'll do it if, you know, as long as there's no objection from anybody. I think the lawyers should always be notified, which I noticed earlier. If you're meeting some real resistance from the judge in your jurisdiction, I would suggest meeting with your judge off the record or maybe considering a meeting with all the dependency judges in your jurisdiction and sort of setting it up almost as a training. You know, you're here to explain to the judge and to educate the judge on the law. I really would encourage all of you to do that, to talk one-on-one with the judge generally about bringing children to court and let them know that it is a common practice in other jurisdictions. It's supported by science. I would really encourage you to do that before you file any legal motions or, you know, go the route of having a writ filed or, appeal something. No judge likes to be appealed. No judge wants to be writted. So, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. All I'm saying is, I would go the diplomatic avenue first. Hopefully you'll get the result you should get that way. And, if after approaching it diplomatically and gingerly and you don't get the results you want, then I think you need to file a legal motion. I think it's absolutely your job to do that. And I would encourage you not, I tell my lawyers all the time, don't be afraid of a judge yelling at you. And I know it's not fun. I spent, 14 years as a public defender being yelled at by judges regularly. And I think, you have a job to do. And if the judge isn't doing what you think is in the child's best interest, it's absolutely your obligation to bring whatever legal motions you need to if the judge isn't listening to you otherwise. So that's pretty much all I have. I don't know if there are any questions.
Great, Judge. And we really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come and talk to the guardians ad litem. I just have a couple quick questions, and then I'll open it up to the group. Is there anything that you would want in advance from the guardians ad litem to prepare you for their clients coming? I know that you said that you want to have a heads up that they're coming, but is there anything in particular that you would want from the guardians before they bring their clients?
Yeah, I think the judge needs to be familiar with the situation, with the case, before they speak to the child. Sometimes, if it's a newer, I remember a lot of my cases now, so it's not hard. But sometimes if a child shows up, and I wasn't prepared for it, then I'll ask the guardian for a moment to trigger my memory, remind me what's the situation here, and why am I talking to the child.
Okay.
Sometimes it's just an introductory meeting, let me meet the child, and sometimes if there's a specific issue. I mean, today's example was very specific. I needed to speak with this child about whether or not she wanted to have any kind of visitation with her father.
Oh, thank you.
So, I think it's important for the judge to obviously know what the situation is before, you don't want to say something to the child that leads them in the wrong direction or gives them a misunderstanding. So the judge definitely needs to know what the case is about. Make sure the judge knows that ahead of time. And make sure, sometimes people walk in here with the child. I don't want to be looking at the guardian or the case manager in front of the kid saying, hey, what's this all about? I think it's important. I mean, I really like the child to come in and feel welcome and feel like I know who they are. So if it's a child that I'm not familiar with or if it's a case that I'm not familiar with, I'll definitely try to make sure I have enough information and,
okay.
Go from there.
Okay, and on those sort of same lines, what do you want the guardian ad litem to do to prepare the child for coming to court?
That's a good question. I think, I'm sure you all probably have examples. Depending on the age of the child, depending on the situation of the child, you all have a good sense of when a child should actually be in a hearing in court and exposed to what's going on in court, or whether there needs to be one-on-one conversation with the judge, with the guardian present. I think that you need to tailor it specific to that case and to that child. I think that, I really do think it's the judge's job to sort of let the child know everything that they speak of, all the things that I spoke about earlier. To that extent, if you have a judge that's maybe not giving a child a full picture, I mean, you all know your judges, hopefully, or you'll get to know your judges, and I think you need to tailor what you say to the child to prepare them based on the judge. I make sure I let them know now, since some of what you say I may have to use in court, depending on what the topic is. So I guess I think you need to tailor that again. I wish I could be more helpful, but I think my guardians now know me, so they know, I don't know what they do to prepare them, but I mean, they've all seen me enough with the children that they probably know what I'm going to cover and what to prepare me for. But I think you kind of have to tailor it to the child, to the case, and then to the judge that you're dealing with. And I think you also need to think about, I hate saying this, but not every judge is the same. And I don't know, you need to make sure it's really worthwhile for the child to have a conversation, personal conversation with the judge, or whether it's better, it sounds like Justin really never had those conversations with judges, but he was present in hearing. So I think you need to figure out what's best for that kid. And if maybe the judge isn't, I consider myself kind of warm and fuzzy, so I mean, the kids come in and I'm picking up the babies and I'm hugging and I'm doing a lot of stuff, and I'm sure, again, some of my colleagues would look at me and think I was insane, but it's what's comfortable for me. So I think that depending on what you, you know, what you think your judge's comfort level is, again, figure out what the best situation is for the child and guide the case along in that direction. I mean, the guardians, in my mind, have a lot of credibility and a tremendous amount of, I guess, responsibility, and I urge you to guide the case, guide the conversation, guide the contact between the judge and the child in the way that you really think is best. And to the extent that you can sort of talk to people about that stuff ahead of time, maybe the DCF lawyers, whatever, if you're all on the same page, that'd be great. But I think it's really your responsibility. You probably know the child better than anyone else in there to make sure that, you know, the circumstances are what benefits the child in that particular case.
Great. And just one last question. Would you take written statements from a child, like if they do not want to come to court, or if there was a school issue or some other issue that sort of precluded them from coming to court, but they wanted to write to you?
Yeah, I would always accept it. I mean, I think that it's a little bit, depending on the circumstances, I have one case I can think of right now where, you know, there was a lot of contention between the parents. So, and the children are with the mother, and if they're writing me letters from home where they live with the mother, you know, as long as I know the full circumstances and, you know, give the written letter or written whatever, a statement, you know, you have to give it the appropriate weight. But always, I mean, I have children writing me letters all the time telling me what they want. I had two little girls on a case involving sexual abuse saying that they wanted to have contact with their father. And, yeah, I think that, you know, I welcome everything. Honestly, in independency, I can't imagine ever saying, no, I don't want to know something, or saying no to added information. I mean, I think that you need to, it's so different from any other system. You really need to get as much information as possible and then determine what, you know, what each piece of information you get, what how much weight it should be given. But, yeah, I would welcome that. I don't think that takes the place of one-on-one or personal, you know, in-person contact, but in between, you know, if they have school and they've been to see me already once, or they're coming in a month and can't come now, in place of that, a written statement I think would be fine.
Great, great. Okay, and now I'm going to open it up to the audience. Are there any questions for Judge Safi? Okay, great. Again, I as with Justin, I appreciate your time, Judge. Okay, so just really quickly in the last few minutes that we have, I just want to turn to the PowerPoint in slide 3. This is the Child and Family Services Improvement Act of 2006, and I put this slide in there because I think it's important to sort of understand where the feds are in all of this, and that there is a trend moving across the country, and I think, Judge, you actually talked about this as well, that there is really a trend more towards the involvement of kids in their court hearings. And this isn't to say that how we used to do things, like if you ask people 10 years ago, generally speaking, kids did not come to court. Not to say that how we did it then was wrong, but there's really just a change, and I think that it's going to take guardians ad litem and judges and social workers and to really change the whole mindset. So the Child and Family Services Improvement Act requires judges to consult in an age-appropriate manner with the child about their permanency plan. Now, the way that HHS and what HHS does is that their job is to pretty much interpret what the what Congress has said for the states. And what HHS said was that they were not going to interpret this to require that youth come to court, but just that judges be aware of how the child's actual opinion about the permanency plan. So it's not just what is in the child's best interest, but just that that judges are now required to get from either the GAL or the social worker or another stakeholder that what the child's opinion is about the permanency plan.
Andrea, can I point out one thing? I don't know if this is happening across the state. I think it's going to be, but we recently had implemented by the Department of Children and Families I think it started. I think it started by them here, so I'm presuming it's going to be statewide at some point. That for the independent living hearings, we have a new form for our judicial reviews for the children that are in independent living that I think is now uniform across all the agencies that are our providers, that the child who's, you know, heading towards aging out has to sit down, and it's a very long, meaningful questionnaire-type JR that's filled out, and there's many places where the child initials. So the child that's heading towards, you know, aging out has to be present, has to have this one-on-one, and I don't know if that's being done everywhere else, but I think it's you know, for me in court, I sort of presumed that sort of stuff was being done anyway. You presume that independent living means, you know, the child has to have a plan, the child has to identify adults that are going to support them, the child has to have been trained on this, that, and the other thing. And I guess that really wasn't being done, or it wasn't being done across the board. So here now, at least we have a new tool that I can use in court to make sure the child was present and their concerns, you know, were addressed and actually written out, and they've initialed off on this document.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's interesting that you bring that up, because a lot of jurisdictions, and I actually spoke at length with Judge Clark and now the county that she, actually, I think she's in Leon County, is starting an independent living court, and it's the same kind of concept that you were talking about, how she has more of an informal meeting with that are aging out of care. So yeah, and that trend is happening across the country as well. And again, it's concentrating on the input and the empowerment for youth, and to understand that the court is a place where a lot of the decisions about what is going to happen is made, and that youth should feel like they are empowered and that they have input to the court. So just really quickly, slide four was, I just threw that in there about, and it goes through in the articles as well, kind of in detail, what the agencies are talking about. And on slide four, it's pretty much the who's who of child welfare, and the courts, and all of them say that at some point youth should be involved in their court hearings. And then on slide five, just talking about what some states are doing around the country. A lot of states they do this age thing where they say they you know, it's an easy bright line where, you know, any youth over the age of, let's say, 14 is presumed to be brought to court, and then anyone under that age is not. So there are some states doing that, and Idaho actually just passed the youth being 8. But then, you know, we try and discourage that kind of bright line, and that it's really that, as you spoke about, I mean, it's important for judges to see youth of all ages, even very small infants, just to get an idea of what is going on in their lives, and that this case is not about a case file; it's about the youth. And so, having the youth present really helps that. Okay. So, and then on slide six, this is your Florida rule 8.255B. The child has the right to be present at the hearing unless the court finds the child's mental, and you guys can obviously read that. And as I said, in the other handout you have, it really talks about all of the instances in your rules and statutes where child participation is required. And then on slide seven, I just kind of gave some ideas about what are the benefits when youth participate, and it really gives them that sense of control. I mean, when they come into foster care, a lot of their control is taken out of their hand. Choices are made. They have to change schools. They have to change placements. They often don't have the control that they once had over their lives. And allowing them to come into court often helps to at least provide some semblance of control. And then, of course, understanding the process, like Justin talked about, how it just became clear to him because he was able to be involved in his court hearings. And then, as the judge talked about, information for the court. slides 8 and 9, I think it's important to understand that we're not saying that every child in every case should come to every court hearing. I think anyone who sort of makes those very polarizing statements is just not correct. We should really, you know, stop to think about case by case, should a youth come to court, and what hearings should they come to, and should any accommodations be made. For example, what the judge was talking about, how there are times that she's able to talk to the youth in chambers if the youth is uncomfortable speaking in court, or if there's a no contact order with parents. What are some of the other ways to really still include the child? And so some of the questions I just put on slides 8 and 9, things that you should take into account when you're deciding if youth should come to court. And I think that the first one is the most important. Does the youth want to come to court? And I think it's not just a question that, you know, that we're asking, you know, are we calling the youth, you know, the night before the court hearing and saying, oh, by the way, there's a court hearing in the morning, you're going to miss school, you're probably going to have to stay there for a long period of time, and I'm not even sure if the judge is going to talk to you. So, do you want to come? As opposed to saying, giving the youth 2 weeks' notice of the hearing, talking about how important it is, really saying that the court is a place where the youth can express their thoughts and opinions. So really thinking about how we ask youth if they want to come to court, I think, is a huge issue. And so some of the other questions are important. Will attending court upset the youth? And Justin kind of answered that question, but I still think that it's important that if there are things that a youth is going to hear during a court hearing that could potentially harm the child, then let's make accommodations. Speak to the judge in chambers. Split the hearing so the only people in the courtroom are the attorneys and the youth, and have the parents wait outside. So just ways we have to really think creatively when it comes to involving youth in their court hearings. And then on slide 9, transportation. That seems to be a huge issue across the country. You know, who's going to transport kids? And as the judge said, that's not really an excuse for not bringing youth to court. And really trying to brainstorm ideas about who can bring the child, that it should not always be on the agency, but could an aunt or a coach or a family member bring the youth to court. So really trying to be creative about how we get youth to court hearings. Slide 10,
what was that?
I'm sorry?
In the fish with olives.
Is there a question? Okay. On slide 10, we talk about tips for involving youth in their court hearings. And again, the same kind of thing that I was just talking about, we shouldn't presume that there are only two options, either having the youth present in court for the whole time or not having the youth present at all. There are ways to really involve the youth creatively in their court hearings, and those are on slide 10, some examples of how to do that. On slide 11, I just put some sample types of questions that youth should be asked during their court hearings. What I don't want to see, and what I have seen, is that youth come to court and they're not really engaged by the judge or any of the parties. It's important that it's not just to have the youth present, but if they're comfortable, really talking to them about their placement, about their visitation, about permanency planning, education issues. How are they doing in school? I mean, kids spend the majority of their time in school, so having the judge talk to youth about their school, and then of course their health issues. Slide 12 really just kind of talks about how we can, as a system, change the way we do things to increase youth participation in court. And I think that the first thing to do is obviously change the statute and the court rules. And you all in Florida have a fairly well written court rule about the fact that youth should come to court absent a judge finding that it's not in the child's best interests. Other things is, if we skip down, the agency policy. This is really going to take a change in the mindset of the agency. We have so many times that the barrier is that the agency does not want to bring the child to court. So it's really training and really going in there and changing the mindset of the agencies. And school accommodations. To ensure that we are talking with the county board of ed and the state board of ed and ensuring that youth are not punished when they are not in school and that it's an excused absence to attend their court hearings. And then also will teachers give some homework for the youth to do while they're waiting for their court hearings? I mean, as a guardian ad litem, you could talk to your client's teachers and say, is there anything that my client can be doing so that my client does not miss out on any of the schoolwork? Slides 13 and 14 kind of really talk about the guardian's ad litem role in involving youth in their court hearing. And on slide 13 is kind of generally speaking that you have to know how to interview kids. We have to have reasonable caseloads. We really have to explain our role to the child, you know, that we are the child's advocate and explain the confidentiality issues. And it's important, of course, to see your client and also to provide to the court the youth's voice. And then in court, the guardian ad litem is the most important person when the youth is in court. You're the one who has to explain to the youth in advance what is going to happen, who's going to be there, where everyone is going to sit, what potentially the judge could ask the youth. So really, in advance, preparing your client for coming to court, informing the court in advance if there's going to be any issues, allowing your client to speak if your client wants to speak, and ensure during the court hearings, when I was a practicing attorney, my kids would sit up at the bench with me, and if they had any questions, I would stop and ask for the court's indulgence and show the child that their understanding was paramount. And then afterwards, take the time out to speak to your client about what happened. Do they understand what happened in the court hearing? And the last couple of slides are a lot of states have pamphlets for youth about their rights. These are a lot of the things that we're telling the youth. They have the right to talk with their guardian ad litem in advance before hearings. They have the right to attend their court hearings. So those kinds of things we're already telling youth that they have the right to do. So I know that we sort of went really quickly through that, but I want to be extremely respectful of your time. So if there are there any questions for any of us, either Justin, Judge Safey, or myself, are there any questions? Any struggles or any obstacles that are occurring in when we're trying to bring youth to their court hearings?
Andrea, this is Mary Kay. I just wanted to share with people, I know some of you may be sitting there thinking, well, we're not in Miami, and it's different up here in rural northern Florida. But in our circuit, for a long time, the practice really was for children not to come to court. And at the Dependency Summit last year, that was raised as an issue, and the judges became aware, and the guardian program was really instrumental in getting an order that the children be brought, and the magistrate and our circuit judge followed through on those orders, and, you know, the system has not ground to a halt. I mean,
I think the docket is very, it's just as efficient as it was before children were brought to court. So, I mean, I'm not in dependency court every day in the circuit, but my understanding is that it's sort of like it is now in Miami, where it's not really an issue. I mean, it's the kids are there if they want to be there or if there are issues. So, I would like to encourage you in the smaller areas that think that this is an insurmountable obstacle. It really, it can be something that you can make happen, and you guys really you're in the best position to facilitate it happening for the kids on your cases.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just think that we are the voice of this child, and it's just so important that part of our job is to ensure that youth are empowered and that their voice is heard with the judges. And so, and I know it's a huge city that we have. I agree with that 100%. And so I think that we're in the best place to ensure that youth are being brought to court. And I agree with the judge who said that, off the record, talk to your judges and encourage them to involve kids in their court hearings, and encourage them to come to trainings about youth in involving youth in court. So, any other questions or thoughts?
I have a question, please.
Yes.
What about children in residential care that are not allowed to participate because of her behavior? Now, I can say that one second that this is the third time she's not being allowed to come. She's allowed to participate over the phone. And then also, if you could address the children in DJJ custody and to what extent we can compel their participation.
Okay, I can start. I mean, from what I see from your court rule, there isn't anything, at least that I can see, that would preclude a youth from coming to court unless
there is, Andrea, just to there is a specific provision in the RTC rule regarding the child's presence. The court has to make a finding. So if the department needs to be filing, I mean, in my opinion, if the department's going to be asking that the child not attend court for the RTC hearing, the department needs to file a motion before the hearing, or you need to somehow bring it to the court's attention, because the court does need to make a finding as to the child, whether or not it's in the best interest of the child to attend the hearing. And this is a huge problem, because what happens is that some of the facilities use that, I don't know if punishment is the right word, but they deny the child the opportunity to travel. And then, frankly, with some kids that have severe behavior problems, it isn't safe for them to travel, because it involves a caseworker driving potentially many hours with the child, and if the child's not stable, that may not be something that anyone is comfortable with. So, but there is a specific provision. I don't recognize your voice. If you'll email me, I'm in Citrix, Mary Kay Wimsett. I'll be happy to give you the exact site.
Thank you.
And I think it's important. I mean, you just talked about the RTC regulation, but the important part of that is that the judge has to make a finding, so they have to proffer to the court why it would not be in the child's best interest to come to court, and the fact that the RTC would use it as kind of a punishment, I would argue that is not grounds, that's not in the child's best interest, and so if I were you, I would, ask for a hearing on the issue of whether the child should come to court or not, and force the agency to proffer evidence or to bring evidence to show why it's not in the child's best interest to come to court, and really impress upon the court how important it is to the child to be empowered and to feel like they're involved in the court process.
As far as children in DJJ, I don't think it should ever be an issue, because we have parents who are incarcerated who come to court. So I see no issue whatsoever with the children that are in juvenile justice custody. For the kids that are in a psychiatric placement, I think I usually have the if the guardian says to me that, and I'm the guardian's usually in contact with the doctors and the treatment team, I usually follow their lead. So I think it's important for the guardians on those cases to stay not only in contact with the child, but stay in contact with the treatment team and really have an idea whether it's good for the child to come to court. If the child needs to come to court, if I order it, the child's going to come to court, unless it's, you know, truly a safety risk to the child. So
I would...
Go ahead.
So I was just going to add, in terms of the DJJ kids, there are a lot of logistical issues that go into getting a child transported, especially if they're in a DJJ facility that's out of your circuit.
That's
so
right.
You cannot wait until the day before court. You have got, and the sheriff's offices in certain areas, I remember when I practiced in the Panhandle, you know, they have to have weeks notice. You're going to most likely have to get an order. They are not going to transport a child if you call up. So it does take legwork on your end. And the easiest way to deal with it in terms of reducing your paperwork and your work is to get it court ordered at the previous hearing and make it a specific, make sure it's in the order. And then you can provide that order to law enforcement. Because a lot of times, it varies everywhere in terms of whether DJJ brings the kids to court or whether DJJ hands them over to the sheriff's office or to the local police or how they do it.
Any other questions? Okay, great. Well, I really appreciate the time that everyone took, and I hope that it was helpful.